to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is WebSphere MQ for COS Dump Analysis. Today's presenters are Kenneth Haley and Bethany Kingsley. Kenneth is a senior member of the MQ for COS Level 3 service team in Hursley Labs in the UK, where MQ is developed. Kenneth joined IBM 7 years ago and has been supporting MQ since version 5.31 was released. His prime area of expertise is debugging and has written most of the REXX IPCS debugging aids in use by MQ support teams across the world. Prior to that, he spent 25 years with MDEL in the Worldwide Diagnostic Assistance Center working on operating systems, firmware, and hardware problems for a wide variety of customers on a range of hardware platforms. As a systems programmer, he has been working with IBM systems since 1967. Bethany is an experienced support software engineer working with the IBM WebSphere MQ Level 2 support team in Raleigh, North Carolina. Bethany joined IBM 22 years ago after spending 5 years at ExxonMobil as an IMS systems programmer. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Kenneth and Bethany.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to today's presentation, WebSphere MQ for ZOS Dump Analysis. Can we move to slide 2, the agenda? First of all, I would like to go over what we have for you in this presentation. To start off, we talk about the different types of dumps available to MQ and how to take them. Then we talk about preliminary steps you should take before even starting to look at the dumps. We then talk about viewing MQ job logs and or the system log, looking for any relevant errors and configuration information as part of the diagnosis. Then we get into IPCS specifics. This is where we show you how to use a combination of native IPCS commands and MQ built IPCS commands that come with the MQ dump formatter. We will give you examples of typical situations for which you or the system may take a dump. For example, if you have a dump of the queue manager address space, we will show you commands to diagnose it, the same with the channel initiator address space. Also, you may find you have problems in the areas of clustering or performance, or you may have some sort of storage issues. We will give you commands and hints and tips on how to diagnose dumps taken for these types of error situations. We give you a list of documentation you may need depending on the type of error. And finally, we give you a list of reference documents that will be of help to you when you analyze the problem on your own. Joseph, please move to slide 3. There are several ways you can take an MQ dump. First, you can issue the dump command from the ZOS console, as shown here in the first bullet. Another way is to set the slick trap to take a dump of the master address space, the channel initiator address space, and its data space when a certain error message is issued. For example, when message CSQ X503EZ is issued to the channel initiator job log, as indicated in bullet 2. Thirdly, from MQ version 7 and later, you can use the Recover Queue Manager command to take a dump on the first occurrence of a specific API return code. For example, you can issue the Recover Queue Manager command to take a dump when return code 2108 is used. This will cause a dump of the application and Queue Manager address spaces to be taken. A dump taken this way will have a title, Abend 5 Charlie 6 -00940028. To turn off this trap, use the Recover Queue Manager command with parameters MQRD camera 9999. Another way is to modify the application to issue an MQ open of a special queue named service1.dump using object type MQ02_reserve_1 and open option MQ00_output. This will result in a dump title 5Charlie6-00940Fox001 and return code 2195 will be returned to the application. And finally, you can combine the previous two with a slip trap and the 5Charlie6 reason code to take a dump of, for example, the DB2 address space and or the coupling facility structure in the Chinit data space instead of just the application and the queue manager address spaces. And in addition to the above, of course, dumps are generated when detected by the system. Slide 4, please. Before you start using IPCS, take a few moments to check your IPCS environment. Otherwise, you may find you'll receive errors or be tracing a different problem. For example, verify that the dump has the correct format for IPCS. It should be fixed block spanned with LRECL 4160 and block size 24960. If the format is fixed block, then use ISPF option 3.3 to copy it to the fixed block spanned. If several dumps are generated by the error, you should start with the one with the earliest timestamp. Regardless of whether you run IPCS using the TSO panels or in batch, make sure you point to the correct level of ZOS midlib and the correct level of MQ SCSQ load and SCSQ auth libraries. Make sure you have installed the WebSphere MQ dump formatter as documented in the system setup guide. Joseph, please move to slide 5. Also, check if you have the correct dump. Use ISPF option 1 to browse the dump data set. Enter hex on, and you will be presented with a display similar to what you have seen on this slide here. At decimal offset plus 36 for 1 byte is the dump type. A 01 means it's a standalone dump. 02 means it's an SVC dump. You can see in the example here, about 2/3 down the page in blue, in column 37, is at 02, meaning this is an SVC dump. A 03 means it's a system dump. A 04 means it was taken via slip. At decimal offset plus 72 for 8 bytes is the local time the dump was taken in TOD clock format. In the example, it is Charlie 6, 5, 5, 2 Fox, 1 Able, 1 Able, 2 Fox, Able 8, 7, 2. We note this time since we are going to be using it again. At decimal offset 88, for 100 bytes is the title of the dump. Check if this is what you expect to see. the SDWA offset at plus 372 for 2 bytes. In the example, it is 09 Fox Charlie, followed by 2 bytes length of the SDWA. It is 0618 in this example. If the SDWA offset value is 0, there is no SDWA. An example of this is if the dump was issued from the council. No error, so no SDWA. Note the SDWA value at this offset since we'll need it later. Next slide, 6, please. Before using IPCS, we also need to check the master and chinet job logs and or syslog for anything that might be relevant to the error. For instance, messages CSQY1001 through CSQY108I give the system parameters being used. Message CSQY1000I through CSQY113I gives the log parameters used. And on the chinet job log, a message is CSQX070I through CSQX082I give the chinet parameters on the queue manager attributes, etc. To find MQ error messages in the job logs and or syslog, you need to eyeball the logs. However, Ken has a Rex exec that can do it for you. He can supply it on request if you email him. Next slide, 7, please. Now we start using IPCS. First, we need to set the defaults and initialize the dump. From the IPCS primary menu, choose option 0 to specify the dump data set name and default values to IPCS as shown here. Enter IPCS set def command to set the default length to 4096. The first IPCS command will cause a dump to be initialized. You will see a warning message if the IPCS level does not match the dump. It is important that both levels are the same since it will result in missing and incorrect data. Joseph, please move to slide 8. To find out the ASID's dump on the command, on the command line, enter the IPCBS space RTCT. Then find ASTB in the output. In the example here, is shown ASIDs Able Fox and 9 Charlie were dumped. So check the job names of the dump address spaces. Enter from the command line IP select the ASIDs in question. Now, you can stack pointers so you can easily switch from one address space to another while analyzing the dump as shown in this slide. Next slide, 9, please. Now, remember the local timestamp I asked you to take a note of on slide 5? You can use the IPCS list tab input local command to format the date and time the dump was taken. Also, remember the SDWA offset value? Use it in the IPCS list command as shown here. At offset 4 in the output is their bend code. The PSW is at 68 and the registers start at plus 88, registered 0 through 15. Another way to get the SDWA data is to issue the IP status failed data command. To see if the dump is complete, issue the IP list 0EZ0 for a length of 16. If the output is not all zeros, then the dump is not complete. Slide 10, please. To see if the chain trace was active and was also dumped, go to IPCS Option 1 Pointers panel and select the chain data space as shown here. Once you hit enter, if you get a full page of data displayed, then chain trace was dumped. If you see a short display, then chain trace was not active. If storage not available is returned, then the data space was not dumped. If the dump was taken via slip trap, use the IPCS list slip trap command to see the slip trap parameters used. Use IPCS list 0 domain sdump buffer command to list out the 4K sdump buffer. Following the iCacher regs is the general purpose registers 0 through 15, followed by the iCacher PSW and its value. Joseph, please go to slide 11. Some dumps are generated as a result of a previous failure, and there may or may not be a dump to cover the original failure, depending on the factors like dump suppression, etc. To determine if the dump you have is preceded by another failure, use the following procedure on this slide to find the original error. This is especially useful for Chinit 546-00EZ7014FOX dumps, which results from an earlier failure for which there's usually a master dump. It is this dump you need for diagnosis. Run the IPCS Verdex CSQW DPRD command against the master address space if dump. Search for DMPW. At +62EZ is the dump title. If this is different from the current dump title, then you know there is a previous error and you need to find that dump. Or if it doesn't exist, take steps to ensure that that dump is captured for the next occurrence. Next slide, 12, please. Summary dump data is very essential when looking at the Chinit dump for finding registers at the time of their bend. Issue the IPCS Verbex sum data command, and in the output, look for the PSW regs harms start address. Use that in the IP list command shown here to display registers 0 to 15 at the time of their bend. The resistors are preceded by the iCatcher regs, as shown here. Joseph, please go to slide 13. If you're using shear twos and have problems with your coupling facility, you may find it necessary to format the CF structure from your dump. These are two commands you can use to do it, depending on the level of details. At this point, I will turn the presentation over to Kenneth Hales to continue on slide 14 with the different types of bends and failure situations. Kenneth?
Good morning, everybody. At this point in the presentation, we've got to the point where we have a set of registers. Now, specifically for ABENs which occur in the queue manager address space, okay, when I say in the queue manager address space, I mean in the queue manager address space of a primary, okay, we may be actually home address in a Chinit or an application, but if the primary is the queue manager master address space, then we consider the problem as, an abend in the queue manager address space because we're executing queue manager code. During queue manager code, register 6 is used as a pointer to what's called the execution block, the EB. This is a block which is the same actually in DB2 because MQ was originally built on the basis of a very old version of DB2. So the EB control block is common to both MQ and DB2. MQ control blocks, they always start in the queue manager with a 2-byte hex ID followed by a 2-byte length. Okay? Now, the hex ID for an execution block, an EB, is 0017. So we should be able to look at the value, an IP list on the value from register 6, and we should see a control block that starts 0017. Now, depending on the release of MQ, the length of the EB will actually be different because they have made it longer in version 7 and 7.1. But if register 6 points to a 0017 hex ID, then we have a starting point for looking at the dump. If we don't have, if the value register 6 points at something else, okay, then the best thing to do to find an EB address for the failure is to do an IP summary format on the dump and look at the linkage stack entries for the current TCB, and starting from the last one, okay, go back through them and pick the register 6 value of each one until you find one that points at a hex 0017 code. In other words, then you've found the execution block that belongs to MQ. Now, as I said, the execution block is normally kept in register 6 throughout the whole of MQ code. It's only when we branch off to somewhere else like DB2 that you get something else in register 6. But having got a value for the EB, we can do some list commands to find out something about the thing that appended. And the first one is an IP list of the EB address plus 24 and question mark to load the value plus 88 for a length of 8 gives the job name. Now, what we're doing there is we're going from the EB to the home address pointer. The home address space control element pointer, the ASCE, okay, which contains the job name. So we're getting the job name from the ASCE pointed to by the EB. Similarly, we can find out what type of connection this is. On the next line, you see IP list, the EB address plus Charlie, question mark, plus 18, question mark, plus 34, question mark, plus 80 for a length of 8. That gives the connection type. And in this case, the chain of addresses is going from the EB to the ROB, the ROB. This is a resource options block, to the ACE, which is the agent control element, to the CCB, which is funnily named the composite compatibility block. Now, all of these blocks are the same as they are in DB2. In name, they may be different sizes because MQ has modified them, but the EB, the ROB, the ACE, and the CCB all exist both in MQ and in DB2. And in fact, if you use the same diagnosis, it will probably work in DB2 as well. Okay, so in that field of the connection type, you will see either system, which means it's a system task within the master address space, or you'll see KIX, batch, IMS, RRS batch, or CHIN. This is the connection type. And then finally, the last command there, IP list, the EB value, plus Charlie, plus 18, plus 34, plus 28 for a length of 12, you get out a string of data which tells you roughly what the task is. And the next lines on this foil show an example. If it starts off with a numeric 3-digit value and a dot and then some alphabetics, then it's an MQ service task of sorts. Usually the name means something. Like the example above is EXPCTL01. This is the expiry control task. So you should be able to determine, you know, what it's likely to be from its name. There's a special type of this task which is used for the OTMA T-pipe. And it always starts off at 242. And it's 242.cs and then a six-digit decimal number. And that is actually the T-pipe name, CS and six decimal digits. And knowing that, it's an IMS OTMA task, we can use the Verbex CSQWDPRD, the dump formatter for the master address space, and give it a parameter of IMS equals 1, and you get a whole lot more detail about what that task was doing. Okay, I'm not going to go into detail of what the output is because there simply isn't time in this presentation. Can we go to slide 15, please? Okay, that was IMS. For kicks, that was IMS OTMA. For the kick thread, we get the thread address, okay, which is an address of a control block, the transaction name in character, and the task number in packed decimal. Now, this can be reused to refer to the kick's log or the kick's trace to find out more about what happened. In this example, it's CKTI. For a batch job, the data is usually zeros and is meaningless. For the chinit, there is two types of chinit tasks. One is tasks which run on a dispatcher, and in that case, the second word of this 12-byte value is XX star star, and that indicates that it is a dispatcher process. And the values that you see in the two addresses, the left-hand one, is normally what's called a DPRO address, which is a dispatcher process block address. And the one on the right, offset 8, is the address of a control block called the CLOT. Now, version 7 changed this slightly in that the word at offset 0 can be what's called a conv block, a C-O-N-V, instead of a DPRO, in which case you need to locate the DPRO, and you can get that by going from the plot address. And in the example below, okay, you will see that IP list, the EB plus Charlie plus 18 plus 34, which gets us to the CCB, plus 30, which points to the clock, plus 68 contains the DPRO address. Now, that command needs to be executed in the chinit address space, not the master, because the clock control block is a chinit control block and only exists in the chinit address space. But that will give you a DPRO address regardless of whether there's a DPRO or a conv in that first word. And it's important to get the DPRO address because with that we can find out a lot of other things. The next line down displays from the CCB the channel name, and the next line down shows the IP address, if you want to find out the channel name and the IP address of the failure. To format the chin trace entries for that channel, you use the DPRO address in the command below, CSQXDPRD, subsystem equals SSID, ctrace equals F, DPRO equals the DPRO address. That will give you a lot of information for that particular channel. It'll give you a trace of everything the channel has done. Included in that will be the I.O., both input and output, you'll be able to see, and the flow of control between the various modules in the TINET. To actually find out more about the channel and its status, you can use the CHIST equals 1 on the CSQX DPRD dump formatter and specify a CNAM equals channel name, and that will dump out the status of that channel. There may be multiple instances of a channel if it's a receiver or a server con. So when you put in one channel name there, you might get 5 different lots of data printed. Now, you have to select the right one by looking for the DPRO address in the output. Okay. Can we move on to slide 16, please? Okay, so we can get more information about what's going on in the channel. There's a status summary, and you can get a program trace and a line trace using the command CHST equals 3 to CSQX DPRD. Now, the line trace is a wraparound trace of I/O activity input and output, but it only gives you really times and a little bit of data. You only get about 128 bytes of data. So it's not that useful, but it will tell you if anything's been happening on the channel, and maybe it will indicate whether you need to actually print the whole trace rather than just the line trace. Okay, all that previous information was about the a channel process with a DPRO. There is another format of data from that list command of the 12 bytes I showed you earlier, which starts off T0 in EBCDIC, followed by the TCB address. Now, if you see that format, it's an internal TINET task. Okay, for instance, either it's the repository task or the name server or the timer task or something. There are a few. We'll go into them later. But to format out the TIN trace entries for that task, you can do it by TCB address. IPvervex CXQX, CSQX DPRD subsystem equals, okay, CTrace equals F with TCB equals TCB address. We'll format out just the entries in trace for that TCB, for that task. Okay, for IMS connections, what you get in that 12 bytes of data is the 4-byte process ID and an 8-byte PSB name in character form. Okay, so you can then use that to refer to IMS log or trace or whatever. And there is an IMS control task, and that comes out as just the word control in the 12 bytes in the kit. For RRS batch, it will show the URID of the thread. This is uniquely assigned to each thread within RRS, so you can use that to reference the context. Okay, for looking at what the job connection type is, what the program trace is for an individual task, what queues it has open, what locks it has, and to also get the queue manager trace entries printed for that thread within MQ, you can use the THR equals EB address operand to the CSQW DPRD. This is useful even if you only have a TINET dump. The master trace is actually in ECSA, so it's present even if just the TIN address space was dumped. So you can still run that command, okay, if you know the EB address that failed, even if you didn't have the master dumped. And move on to slide 17, please, Joseph. Okay, more commands from the dump formatter. You can format just the trace table entries for a particular EB address with the CSQWDPRD command with TT, EB equals EB address specified. If you want to format the whole master trace, that's everybody, bear in mind it might be quite big, you can use just TT. Other commands, to find out details of the objects in the system, you can use the MMC equals 1 operand to CSQWDPRD. That will list out the queues, name lists, all the various types of object. Not a lot of detail, but it will give you the names of what's there. If you want local queue details, such as the pacesetter ID, the depth, priority and persistence count, and the subqueue head and tail pointers for a queue, you can use the DMC equals 1 operand. And finally, buffer pool statistics. This will tell you if your buffers have a problem and whether they're big enough or not, or whether you've allocated them too large and they're not being used. You can specify that BMC equals 1 to CSQWDPRD. Now, there are other options available, and you can find them out by giving CSQWDPRD a parameter of question mark in quotes, and that will give you a list, brief list, of what's available. Joseph, can we go to slide 18, please? Okay. We want, perhaps, to find out what is connected to MQ at the time of the dump. Suppose we've had a performance problem, we've taken a console dump. We need to know the threads that are active in that dump. To find that out, you can use the CSQWDPRD dump formatter with THR equals asterisk, thread equals asterisk. This will give you a list of threads known to MQ, and ones that are active in the MQ API at the time of the dump are flagged active in MQ. You can ignore KIX transactions that have a thread value of zeros. This is a rather strange thing. With the new version of KIX, okay, it keeps the transaction kind of sitting there. It's actually ended if the thread address is zero. So you can ignore it if it's thread zero. For the chinit address space in the list of known threads, the PWA address, process work area address, is actually the DPRO address that we talked about earlier, dispatcher process. In fact, the processor work area, process work area, is an XPWA, which is actually at hex offset 218 into the DPRO. So when they write PWA address, they actually give you the DPRO address because there's some stuff early on which is useful. The list of active threads also tells you if a thread is waiting for a latch. And for the threads which are holding latches, it gives you the latch held string, which shows you, who is holding latches. If you've got people holding latches and other people waiting for latches, you can correlate them together and find out who's hanging up who. The next line here, if the URID is shunted, I've never seen this, but Beverly's put this in this report. Shunting is done at version 6 and above to move old, long-running URs, okay, from the previous log into the current log in order that at restart time we don't have to go so far back in the log. So when we're reading the log backwards during restart, it's quicker if it's shunted. And I think in this report, it just marks the fact that the URID has been shunted for this thread. And it also gives you the connection type, TIN, ROS, batch, PIX, IMS, and job name for batch. Later versions of MQ, version 701, also give you the channel name, which is nice. Okay. Joseph, can we have slide 19, please? Okay. Going on to discuss modules and save areas. The purpose of looking at these is to determine the flow of control that led to the problem and allow you to search for similar problems that have already been found and are documented. The code in MQ is written in PLX, assembler, and C code, so you'll find that the modules themselves look very different between the three types. In the QManager code, if you know the EB address, which we've already determined and checked out, okay, if we use CSQW DPRD with THR equals EB address, the thread, it gives you a program traceback, like the example below here, the program unit, and CSQ ER route, CSQ E open, CSQ 5 EPD, and CSQ V EUS 1. The oldest one was at the bottom, the newest one was at the top. Okay. But it doesn't give you the save area of addresses, so it's giving you a kind of flow which helps you find out what's going on, but doesn't give you the save area addresses. Joseph, can we move on to slide 20, please? Okay, save areas, which are pointed to R30, normally, they follow standard save area chaining conventions and do contain an eyeball of the module name. But you have to be careful because at version 7 and above, okay, there may be the ordinary F1 SA save areas, or you might have a format 4 or format 5, in which there are 64-bit registers, and you also have to think about that the module names, okay, for C code, it doesn't have recognizable module names. But in the key manager, as the example here, okay, you can see the eye catcher of CSQ VSRX, which is the suspend resume code. And if we are suspended, we can find out what time we were suspended, which is useful for diagnosis. For V7-V701, the module name is CSQ VSRX, and its dynamic save area plus 2FOX8 contains a Todd clock value. For V6 and below, the module name is CSQ VSR, and its dot clock value is at DSA plus 8 or 0. This is worth knowing. You just pick up the Todd value and do a list dot on it to interpret it. And this can indicate when the thread hung up. If you find times in there which are old, you want to find out why it hasn't been dispatched for a while. Joseph, can we move on to slide 21, please? Okay, the module address, current module address, can be found from register 15 in the previous save area, usually. So you back up one save area from the value in RIG 13. And it normally points you to the module you're in. What you'll find, usually, is a copyright statement at the beginning of the module, followed a little later by a module eyeball. And in this particular example, this is CSQ VSRX from a V701 system. And it has in there a date of 20.09.07.29, and it's got 0.36 GA on there, which is the GA level. This is the kind of thing you'll see if it's a base level module. If the module has had a PTF applied to it, you'll see something like the example in the middle of that slide, okay, for CSQN put, which has a date 2009-11-09 and a PTF number of UK51753. That means that that module is at that level. If we want to find out the PTFs of all the QManager modules, we can use CSQW DPRD with a PTF equals Y in the palm, and it will produce a listing quite large, looking like what's on the bottom of that slide. And it gives you, of course, the dates and whether it's a base level module and whether it's got a PTF applied to it. Joseph, can we go to slide 22, please? Okay, for the Chinit code, it's slightly different. If we use the, for a channel process, if we use the CSQX DPRD with the CHIST equals 3 parameter, that gives a program trace of the module eyeballs. For version 7.0.1, they have changed the compiler, the C compiler that was used. We're now using a Metal C compiler, and this does not generate meaningful names. The module is there, okay, but in previous versions of MQ, we had like the routine name or a short form of the routine name. But in this, all we know, in this example, we can see it's at CN at 27. Which is a compiler-generated name. And it's not even unique, because it might be 275 or 278, and it would still come out as 27, because the compiler truncates it to 8 bytes. So they are not useful unless you have source listings. So for version 7.0.1, only service personnel can interpret those. For V6 and V7.0.0, more meaningful names are in the trace. For instance, you get listings like this, which actually say C program function name, RI send DTA, and RI calent. And these actually correspond. These are short names that correspond to the longer names that you see in the Chinit trace, like RRI send data and RRI caller entry correspond to those two there in the Chinit trace. So this program trace gives you an idea what to look for in the Chinit trace when you look at the full trace. The last save area for a channel process, which is not currently dispatched, can be found from the R13 value in the register set in the DPRO at DPRO plus 38. Okay. And for a currently dispatched channel, R13 from the TCB registers at TCB plus 30 should be used. Okay. Now the question is, how do you determine if the channel is currently dispatched or not? The next slide will cover that. Joseph, can we go to slide 23, please? Okay, to find out if the DPRO is currently dispatched, we need to run the DISP equals 1 parameter into CSQX DPRD. And that will tell us, okay, all the DPROs and which queues they're on. Whether it's active or not is basically defined by whether it's on the active queue. There's only one on the active queue for each dispatcher, okay? But in this report, it will actually say active. And that says it's currently dispatched, and so you should use the TCB registers. Okay. The other thing that you'll normally see in there is it says queue wait. Okay. That means that it has given up control and is waiting for an event to post it to get it redispatched again. And then the registers are actually... the valid registers are in the DPRO plus 38. And of course, if you actually have an abend in the code, you can use R13 from the time of abend instead. Okay, talking about abends and channels, if you use channel exits, in other words, your installation has coded their own channel exits, like a message exit or a security exit or something, it's worth checking the flag in the depro that have ended, okay, at depro plus 27 Charlie. If the hex 20 bit is on in that byte, then the channel exit has been invoked. A channel exit has been invoked, but has not yet returned, okay? So if you have an abend, the abend may be in your user code and not in MQ. So that would give you an indication that you should start looking at the channel exit code, perhaps. And then you can confirm that, okay, by, if you have a trace, you can use the depro address to CSQX DPRD to print the trace, and you will see it calling the exit routine, and you'll see whatever the exit routine did after that. I mean, the exit routine might do an MQ get, or, you know, might issue other MQ commands in there. But anything it did that's related to MQ will be traced. Can we move on to slide 24, please? Okay, to find out if the abend is a channel process, okay, if you get the value of register 13 from the SDWA and equate it to a reg save, and then run the IPEP trace, save area, data R13, order return, it'll print out all the save areas, okay, in order of current back to the first one. From the last save area listed, if you take the EPA, which is the 15 value, and list it, okay, it should point to a copyright statement followed by CSQX pent eyeball, if the failure is for a channel. If it does, then take the value of R8 from the last save area, okay, and if you list it, you should find the characters DPRO at offset plus 4. That indicates that that address is the address of a DPRO control block. So, if that's the case, it's an abend in the channel process. And to find out the channel name, you can use that IP list command, dpro plus 278, question mark plus 28, for a length of 20. Okay. That's going, I believe, to the RRI status block and picking out the channel name from there. To format all the TIM trace entries for that channel, use the depro address again. Or if you just want to look at its I.O., its input and output, you can use the ctrace command, okay, to invoke the trace formatter exit, CSQX exit, with the options specifying the depro address and full trace, meaning the whole of the entry rather than just a summary, and entry ID list of those two values from 0460-9996 to 0460-9999. Those are actually the trace IDs in the trace entries themselves. But that will give you just the input and output that has been done by the channel. So you will see the channel protocol blocks around the data, but you will see the full message as it is received and the full text of the message that is responded by the channel or input and output. It's the only way to see the data that's going down the channel. Can we have the next slide, please, Joseph? Okay, to get more info about the channel and its status, okay, as I said before, you can use chist equals 1 and cname equals channel name. And to get the program trace and line trace, you can use that. The line trace buffer is unformatted, and it's a wraparound trace. Each entry starts with a clock value, readable clock value in EPCDIC, followed by a TOD timestamp and an indication of whether it's an inbound or outbound flow. The easiest way I found to look at it is just to look for the earliest timestamp in character form and start from there. And then you can go down the page and wrap back to the top if you want to continue to the end to look at what's been happening. Okay, so that was when we determined it was a channel from the save area. If it's not a channel, okay, then we need to use IPvivX sumdump and format the RTM2 address, okay, from the RTM2 work area address, and find the current TCB address, and continue from there, and as we would normally debug a TCB. Our next slide, please, Joseph. Thank you. Okay. So we find the current task, okay, and then we can run this command, CSQX DPRD, the subsystem equals SSID, and no other parameters. And that'll print a lot of control blocks. And you can find in that printout, you can find the XGWA to find its address. Alternatively, you can do it a different way. You can IP select job name SSID chin, okay, and that will display the ASCB address for the chinet, and then if you list the ASCB address plus 150 hex question mark plus 94, that will give you the XGWA address. That's actually from the ASSB. ASSB plus 94 contains the XGWA, which is like the chinet CVT. So, given that address, the XGWA, we now want to find out which task this TCB belongs to. Now, the task pointers are all held in the XGWA at these addresses. You'll notice that if you look down the list, that for the listener TCBs, there's an extra question mark in there, plus 18. Well, we're actually going to the listener control block to get the address of the TCB in that case. It's not directly in the XGWA. But these are the normal ones that you'll find in a V6 system. The JST info is the job step info. This is the task that runs when you first bring it up. And it is responsible for monitoring channel starts and stops and stuff like that. The software info is the one that handles tasks stopping and starting. And then the listeners, obviously you've got a TCP listener for TCP IP and an APPC listener for LU62 SNA stuff. You have an NServe TCB, which is a name server. That's the lookup of the name from an IP address or the reverse. That's used for putting out the error messages to tell you what IP address and what connection name has failed. The util.info TCB, that only exists during command processing at chinet startup. After that, the TCB ends and the address stays there, but it will no longer point at a TCB. You know, there's a TCB identifier at TCB plus 200. If you list that address, you'll find it's something else, not a TCB. later on in processing. The next one there is the repository task on TCB. This is for clustering. The repository task handles all the chat between clustered queue managers and the maintenance of the repositories in both the local and the remote ones. Then, as well as the two listeners we had before, we also have shared listeners, timer task, and this thing called an OnCB task, which is the cache storage extend. This is if you have a dynamic clustering cache, it has to be able to extend it when it runs out of space. And the storage is actually owned by the queue managers, so it has to have this special task, the OnCB task, which requests the queue manager to give it some more storage. Can we go to the next slide, please? Okay, as well as those tasks, for version 7 and above, we have some additional ones for PubSub and async notify, and these are kept at these addresses here. Okay, now those are the static TCBs that I've talked about. They're the ones that everybody has, okay? If it's not one of those, then it's got to be a task of which you can specify the number of them, like it's got to be an adapter or an SSL service task. So to find out which one of those it is, you can use this command csqxdprd. You can ask it to print task equals 1, listener equals 1, and dispatcher equals 1, okay? And if you do that on the screen and do a report view command followed by xall and find TCB all, you'll get a list of all the TCBs in that report. It has adapters, SSL, tasks, listeners, dispatchers, supervisor, end server, and repos TCB addresses. That report view, by the way, if you're not familiar with it, this is when you issue an IPCS command that formats stuff directly on the screen. You can put it into ISPF view format by entering the report view, report space view on the command line. And then you can use view commands to edit it, like xall and find. Very useful. Okay, and again, remind you that if you want to format the TIN trace for a particular task, you need to specify TCB equals TCB address and ctrace equals F. Okay, can I have the next slide, please? Slide 28. Okay, this is a little bit of information about diagnosing a slow response in the TINIT. Usually users complain that their applications on the remote end are timing out. They're not getting their response in time. The first thing, obviously, you have to check is that all the required channels are started and running, okay? And you can do that from the dump with the CHST equals 1 report from CSQXDPRD, which I mentioned earlier. But there is one other thing that's important to check. Having checked that the channels are started and running, okay, you then need to check that you have enough dispatchers and adapters. Okay, because if you don't have enough, you will get queuing for the adapters, and that will slow things down dramatically. You can find that out by using verbex csqxdprd, subsys equals ssid, task equals 1. And the queue for the adapter service will be shown like it is here in this example on the foil. It tells you what the API request is that's pending and for which XPWA. So if you have a lot of these, and by a lot I mean more than about 30, then you need to worry that you don't have enough adapters and you need to increase them. We recommend for a large production system 30 dispatchers and 30 adapters. Now, from what I see with the dumps coming in, I see few people actually running with that configuration. They've usually got less. There is, in the performance reports for V7 and V701, there's a statement that says there is no additional overhead for specifying too many. So if you have this problem where they are queuing for adapter service, increase them, because otherwise you will be slowing down your responses to the channel. Basically, you know, the channel can't run because it's waiting for an API request, and the API request is not completing because all the adapters are busy, and that slows down throughput. Okay, we also need to check that the messages actually were sent to their correct destination, and after destination on that line there, it should have a comma, via the system default transmit queue, which is a new thing, which you can define, but if you do define it, if there's no other destination it can put the message to, it will go to this system default transmit queue. And if you do not have a channel servicing that queue, okay, it will just sit there and it will appear as though the message has got lost. Okay, so you will need to check the queue depths with CSQW DPRD DMC equals 1 for the XMIT queues to see if you have something sitting where it shouldn't be. Other things you can look at for performance, accounting trace. The accounting class 3 trace, desk to SMF, it gives a lot of SMF records for each transaction in the MQ system, and it gives you detailed timings, CPU and elapsed on the various API calls and how many of them there are. So you can see if there are any delays in the API from the SMF accounting data. And there does tend to be a lot of it, so it's best to just turn it on for a short while you have the problem, and then turn it off again, and then look at the data. Finally, if the SMF data doesn't give you enough information, the only real thing you can do is run a GTF trace with of the master and chinit job names with user 5EZ9, 5EZ Eagle, 5EZ Baker, and 5EZ specified, and that will give you a more complete picture of the API calls. But it needs a large amount of space. You'll need at least 1,000 plus cylinders of DASD space for the trace data set. And, of course, while we're checking on performance, we also want to check the buffers with the CSQW DPRD BMC equals 1 report. Anything that's bad in there is annotated with an asterisk problem, asterisk comment. Often, it labels things as a problem when there's only a very small problem, so you need to carefully look at what it's flagging and work out if it really is a problem or not. You know, if it's flagging that you have real I.O. on the page set and you've only had 10 I.O.s, you shouldn't be bothered about that. But if you've had 50,000, you need to worry. Joseph, can we have slide 29, please? Okay, clustering problems. These are perhaps the most difficult problems in MQ to diagnose, because the cause of the problem is often something that happened up to 90 days ago, and all record of it is now gone. So it's not always possible to actually diagnose the cause of the clustering problem. But you need to get some more information to look at it. First of all, you need to dump both the master and the chinit together in the same dump. This is so that we can see the residual queue data in the MQ buffers for the repository queue and the command queue. You know, if you have them in separate dumps, it makes it very awkward to do it. You need them in the same dump so that you have a consistent set of data between the chinit and the master. So you can format the local repository with CSQX DPRD class equals 1. If the full repository is on a different system, you also need a master chin dump of that system as well and run a similar report, because with clustering, it's usually a mismatch between a partial repository and a full repository that's causing the problem. So we do need to see the data that is in both of them. If, for instance, you've got your full repository on a distributed system, say Solaris, then you will need an AMQ RFTM dump for that system, which actually, you know, produces a report, which is very like the CSQX DPRD class equals 1. And it contains all the cache definitions for the cluster queues, cluster queue managers, and subscriptions. So we need that for both the full repository and the partial repository in order to check that they are the same. Okay? And if there are any differences, we need to be able to explain why. Otherwise, we have a bug. Okay, you can verify the channel statuses, as I said before, with CHST equals 1. Check that all your cluster channels are working. And, of course, if you have a problem with clustering and the repository is not starting, make sure that system cluster command queue is not get inhibited, because it won't work at all. Clustering won't work at all if it is get inhibited. Now, it does go get inhibited when it's had an error. So in order to get around the error, you need to reset that get enable that to a queue for it to be able to start again. The other thing that sometimes causes a lot of problems with clustering is a poison message. This is a message which comes into the system, usually into the system cluster command queue, and gets executed and causes a problem, an abend in the repository task, for instance. And then, of course, because the task abends, the message gets backed out, put back on the queue. Okay, you restart your repository after 10 minutes, okay, and it comes back up and it receives the same message again and fails again. So in that scenario, we need to see the message. So we need to get a copy of System Cluster Command Queue to actually look at the message and find out what's wrong with it. It can be various causes of failures. We need the data. Okay, Joseph, can we go to slide 30, please? Okay, excess CPU usage is the next foil. Really, we don't keep any record of CPU usage except in the SMF data. So if you're not collecting SMF data, you won't find out where the CPU is being used. The one place you can see things happening is in the sys-trace, with clock comparator RUPs, which are labeled EXT1005s. And there is some help from the sumtrace exec, which is in the secret IPCS 2.6i menu. And if you're in IPCS and you type equals 2.6i on the top command line, you will get a new menu, okay, of execs that you can use. Some of them are quite fancy. The one I'm interested in is the sumtrace. And sumtrace processes the sys-trace data and produces a report of where the CPU is used by ASID, TCB, and SRB. And it tells you where all your clock comparator ruts are taking place and how many in what place. So you can find that there are places where the CPU is being interrupted. The clock comparator rupt happens when somebody's in control. If somebody's always in control at the same place, then you've likely got a loop. So this is important. Clock comparator rupts in IGV-GPVT, IGVE-GPVT, IGVFS-TQE, and IGWSTOR. Okay, these are in Getney and Freemain, and they indicate that private storage is fragmented, and we have a lot of control blocks, DQEs and FQEs, and we need to investigate why. We need to look at the storage and find out what is in there. Okay. The excessive clock comparators in CSQ IMG 3 and 7, or IMG 4, indicate processing long page chains in the queue. Okay, and you need to determine from the master trace which queues are in use, and see if those applications that are using those queues could work with the queues being indexed instead of being processed serially, which will reduce the number of accesses considerably. Other CPU usage, you really need to use something like an OEM monitor, such as strobe, okay, to find out exactly which modules the CPU is being used in, and then you can take it from there. Determining where the CPU is being used is quite hard. Slide 31, please, Joseph. Okay, out of storage bands, these are 80As, 878s, this kind of a bend. These we have to find out, you know, who's using what storage to cause the problem. Indications of out of storage bends, from MQ version 6 onwards, the queue manager told you how much storage it was using and how much was free. And it tells you if a storage crisis has arisen, gives you a warning message. And from version 7, the TINET does that in the same way with the CSQX004i message. And looking for these can show you, it can indicate when the problem started to happen. Yeah. So to diagnose them, you have to check those messages and correlate them with increases, correlate the increases with other events in the job log and syslog. Use systrace for the failing ASIC to find the send storage request. You'll normally find that the storage request in systrace, and you can look and see if it's for a local or global storage pool, i.e. in ECSA or SQA. Or LSQA, rather than the actual region size of the TINET or master. And you also need to check the flag to see if it was specifically for below-the-line storage, because there's much less below-the-line storage, and some things do need to be below-the-line to the 24-bit addresses. So it's important to find out whether we've run out of storage below-the-line or above-the-line. Okay, next slide, please, Joseph, 32. If it's a global pool, you can use the Verbex VSM data own com with an ASID list for the master, and sort by time, if you want to sort by time, to see if you suddenly started using a lot of common storage. In that report, you'll see the address where the storage was obtained and the time at which it was obtained. For a local storage pool, you can use Verbex CSM data no global summary with the job name on it and determine which subpools are abnormally large. For the master address space, subpool 229 key 7 contains almost everything to do with MQ in local storage, but that is not in the, it doesn't come out of the region size. Okay, it's private high storage. And for the chinette, subpool 0 key 8 is normally very large, but you need to compare it with another dump to see if it's larger than it normally is. Okay, and you need to check the region size from that report as well. There's an example at the bottom there. We recommend specifying region equals 0M, but of course the region size may be limited by an installation exit, so even though you specified a lot, you may be only getting a little because somebody's written an exit routine to limit you. And you can check that in that report. And then finally, you need to actually look at the subpool storage. You know, pick out some blocks, some DQE addresses, and look and see what's in them, and see if there's an excessive number of a particular type of control block. You may be lucky. Next slide, please, Jess. It's 33. Okay, IP Verbex VSM data, no global detail. That, if you look at that, you will find that the FPQEs are listed, okay? And it's important to look at them and find out what the largest areas are, because if the largest free block queue element is only, 12K long, and we need 16K in our storage request, we're going to fail. So we need to know what's fragmented them, and what we need to do is look between the FPQEs and look for DQEs with FQEs where only a single area remains allocated, implying that, everything's been freed except this little control block, which we're leaking. So we need to determine what's being leaked and take the diagnosis from there. If the problem's in the chinet, Servicon channels can cause a problem if they require data conversion and they have specified a very large MQ buffer size on their MQ get. What this causes is a large staging area equivalent to the MQ buffer size has to be allocated in the chinet inside an XSTB, by the way, which is a sort of containing control block. And that gets allocated for data conversion, and it is kept, okay, between MQI calls. And we do some attempts to optimize the size, but if the user is specifying very large MQ buffer sizes, there's not much we can do about it, and that's one way to run out of storage. The other thing you need to do is to check that all the known storage leak fixes are applied. Yeah, they should all be hyper. Yeah, so you just need to check the hyper list. One other thing which I came across the other day, and that is that it's possible for DB2 to cause a problem for MQ in a shared queue environment. In this particular case, okay, DB2 had no active log available because it had a problem with its logging tapes. And what happened there was that all access to DB2 hung. And, of course, in the shared queue system, we do need access to DB2 to update objects, particularly for triggering and stuff like that. So the shared queues were still running, and requests were just stacking up in the MQ master for triggering changes, and they were all being queued because the particular DB2 request that was in the DB2 server, okay, was hung in DB2 because he had no active logs on which to log the transaction. So that's another thing to look for. Look for DSNJ messages with an E on the end, to see if there is a logging problem in DB2 at the time of the failure. Next slide, please, Joseph. Okay, I'm going to turn this back over to Beverly to run through the documentation and diagnosis referral documents. Thank you very much.
to speed things up a little bit more, on slide 34, this slide, on slide 35, it's a list of required documentation that you may need while going through your diagnosis. And on slide 35, 36, and 37, is a list of reference material that you may use during the diagnosis. Now, Joseph, slide 38, please. Now, to summarize this presentation, we covered the different ways to take an MQ dump, dumping the necessary information needed to resolve the different types of problems. We talk about how to verify that the dump is suitable for IPCS, and how to identify if you have the correct dump. We stress the need to look for messages with MQ configuration information and to look for error messages issued to the MQ job logs and or syslog. And we cover the ZOS, IPCS, and MQ IPCS commands used in diagnosing master internet abandons, clustering, performance, and storage problems. We listed the documentation and reference material that you need to analyze the various problems. Now, slide 39, please. This slide has some useful WebSphere MQ links. For example, the link to the MQ library, MQ home page where you search for known problems. Next slide, slide 40, please. This slide, this short includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts like the one you attended today, and access previously recorded presentations. DeveloperWorks offer in-depth technical information. Visit WebSphere.org for users group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up the learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notifications link and all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates and products of interest to you. That concludes the session today. I will turn the presentation back to Joseph for the question and answer response. Joseph?
Thank you, Kenneth, and especially for a great presentation. At this point in time, Grainy, we would like to open the lines for questions.
It looks like we have no questions at this time.
Thank you, Grainy. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.